This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Over these many years on Cadenza, I've chatted with a number of young string quartets that seek to expand the style, genres, sound world, techniques, and perspectives of this time-honored, illustrious chamber music ensemble, the String Quartet. All these adventurous young groups, such as the one we had on last week's program, the Public Quartet, named two quartets as their mentors, the pioneers, the Kronos Quartet and the Turtle Island Quartet. Today we'll chat with the founder of Turtle Island and still member, violinist David Balakrishnan. Deriving its name from Croatian mythology found in Native American folklore, Turtle Island began organically with my guest, trying to fuse his love, passion, and talent in jazz improvising and performing with the standard classical string quartet. Getting going in the Bay Area in the mid-1980s, after stints of playing in such American music adventurous roots groups headed by the likes of David Grisman, my guest wanted to fuse his passion and talent in that area of jazz improvisation with the string quartet. It really had never been done before, so he began forming Turtle Island with violinist Daryl Anger, then cellist Mark Summer, who stayed in the group all the way up till just recently. Over the years, the group has moved through a number of violists, and there have been other personnel changes as well. But my guest remains the anchor, now surrounded by three dynamic, jaw-dropping young musicians. Along these decades, Turtle Island, at first a renegade in this arena, gained respect and recognition from all sides of the music spectrum. Their recordings have garnered Grammy Awards and much other acclaim. They have collaborated not only with top classical artists, ensembles, and orchestras, but with some of the world's leading jazz musicians. Their morphing of the jazz and classical world and the results they produce have made them stand out over these years. You're listening to them perform jazz great John Coltrane's Moment's Notice from their recording titled Love Supreme. It was on their U.S. tour last fall, reviving the Love Supreme theme, where I was able to speak with David Balakrishnan just before Turtle Island's concert in Doylestown, PA. I am here very happy to be talking with David Balakrishnan, who is violinist and composer, and of course founder, one of Turtle Island Quartet. And we're talking just before you could do a concert here in Doylestown, PA. We're across the river in Jersey here, of course. And Doylestown is not only a beautiful town, it's a very cultural, artistic area, though admittedly, it's not Carnegie Hall, it's not downtown San Francisco or LA, and most of the audience that will show up will know exactly what to expect. Though, of course, due to the nature of your concerts, every concert's different. But others may see that you're a quartet, a string quartet, and they might be coming not quite knowing what they're getting themselves into, to use a pejorative there. So here, even after 30 years that you guys have been around, Turtle, this is still must be a common thing. And how do you go out and make sure that you're bridging and communicating and performing to everyone in the audience, no matter where they're at on the Turtle Island sliding scale there?
That's a very well put, David. And it is means that it's a good thing to be constantly aware of staying in the basics of what you're doing and why and how and these things. The string quartet form itself isn't a given in the arts world. I mean, nothing is.
Right.
Everything is always in flux. And I hope some folks would come to see our concerts and maybe not even have the slightest clue what a string quartet is. It would make me happy to know that, because it gives us a chance to do a few things. One is, on the most basic level, to reaffirm the elegant beauty of the string quartet form as it is, just as an empirical form, as a structure in sound on this planet. And of course, that's a huge subject, and I do like to speak a little bit to it, because it kind of gives you a reason why we would even do what we're doing.
Sure.
Which Turtle Island Quartet is primarily known for having found a way to play jazz music and jazz-inspired approaches in the string quartet form, serving a idiomatic part of the style as opposed to classically trained players playing from that standpoint. And that alone is a big mouthful. So I will take a breath at this point and try to explain myself a bit more for folks who've never heard of string quartet, for you out there. It started somewhere about 250 years ago in Europe. I like to say it's very similar to the way voices work. In the Western music world, we have this thing called SATB, which is also known as soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. And it's this classic idea of four parts that is very much the essential ingredient in the language of Western music, of the Western culture. So the string quartet's set up just like that. So instead of singers, you have these hollow wooden boxes with sticks that we drag across, and they create this glorious, homogeneous, rich sound together that, well, I can say theoretically gorgeous. That's the idea.
Right.
That's the basis of what the model is. And even though all these hundreds of years later, there has been all this innovation that's happened, of course, in so many ways, not only in the West, but all over the world for string instruments, there is a way that the form, with the way we are approaching it, we're very dedicated to make sure that those who know that sound will recognize that's the same creation as Haydn. That is the same animal, and see that we're coming with a great deal of respect to that tradition and just trying to expand the parameters of it as opposed to break the mold.
I think that's one of the real hallmarks of Turtle Island, is that whether you're playing a piece by you, whether playing Coltrane or Bob Dylan, somewhere, at least to my ears, somewhere in that version of what you guys play, it sounds like a string quartet, which it just is quite amazing, actually, when you think about it. You just given the thumbnail history of the quartet, going back to Papa Haydn there, that it still can sound like those four instruments conversationally and vocally lined up, and it works. You know, that's the thing. It works. It's a successful group.
There's so many beautiful aspects. I mean, it is a 30-year-old group, and for me, it was my baby. I first, back when I was in my late mid-20s, I'd say, I was this guy who was trained in classical music, but had long, since I was a kid, always been involved in improvising on the violin. It was really radical to do back. That was a long time ago, and there weren't a lot of people approaching it that way. And I got attracted to all sorts of styles, and I fell in love in all sorts of ways with Stefan Grappelli, fiddle music, with Indian classical music, with great classical compositions, and all these, you know, the world of music was exploding for me. And at some point, I found that I just didn't have any sense of who I was. Like, I didn't know how I fit in all of it. And at that point, I started experimenting with writing string quartet music with this idea that all of the four players would be just like me, just like this wide range of training and in all these styles. And then me as the composer would have access to a group that could play my music with the right accent. So there wasn't a group like that around at all. I actually first just overdubbed myself, and that at least gave me an idea of what it might sound like. But of course, that's incredibly limiting. As luck would have it, the time was right for folks to gather together and make this real. And so from that point on, I found my voice. And all these years later, I'm very lucky to still have a place for my voice to sing through. And along the way, my goodness, I've worked with so many great musicians, not only in the quartet, but all these amazing collaborations. If you would have told me I would be playing with Paquita de Rivera or Billy Taylor, or I don't want to throw out names, it's like name dropping, but I would say, no way, no
right,
way.
Right.
It's like not so. I'm really grateful for that.
It's interesting. Over the years of this program, I've had a lot of string quartets, from the completely well-established people like the Emersons down to the kids on the block, you know, and there's so many of them. And to a T, not all of them, but to a T, they've formed in school because they knew each other. They were formed by a mentor or a teacher, and they came together. And like you just said, this started with 1-1, which was you, 1+1, another violinist, 1+another, a third, a cello. Then you had to go find a violist. And you mentioned Paquita. I love that quote. You were trying to find a improvising violist. He said, it's like trying to find a barking cat. I love that quote. I know it's old, but it's really still good.
No, it speaks to the viola. I mean, the viola is like the butt of so many jokes.
Right.
There's a string player out there, you know, just what I'm talking about. So the viola is like the banjo or the accordion in different music styles. There's probably a butt of jokes in other frameworks, right? There must be. Okay. But anyway, the viola joke, violas, they're interesting people because generally if you're attracted to playing the viola in the classical tradition, you like to be in the middle of the group, you know, and you like to be playing in the middle of the sound. And the joke is that violas are they're made fun of for various reasons. Maybe because their role is so much in the nuts and bolts,
they like to blend in the middle of the sound of the group.
To be a jazz violist, that is a total different model, because to play jazz, you have to be all about showing off.
Right.
You have to be like about soloing and, hey, listen to me. I got this to say. I got that to say. And also playing on top, you know. And so violas, here's the ironic part about it, is the viola of all the bowed string instruments, the viola, I will postulate, is the absolute best for playing jazz. So somebody that really knows how to play jazz, I'm always jealous about the viola because it's a hard instrument to play, and I'm happy to stick with the violin. So if you hear somebody playing jazz and a viola, it's much more the sound of a saxophone.
A tenor sax,
Versus the violin's more in the clarinet, kind of like sounds too high from a traditional jazz standpoint.
Yeah.
So
I told how the group got formed, that sort of very organic way you came together, and because of that prerequisite, which was having improvisatory skills. You mentioned viola. You had some violists over the 30 years who were actually violinists who just wanted to play with the group, so they picked up the viola.
Yeah, that was the simplest way to solve the problem. You know, the other part about this whole idea of soloing on string instruments is because this is such a unprecedented thing, generally speaking, to do in the Western cultural model, obviously in the classical side for sure, but in general, you have to be kind of a rebellious, strange fellow or woman, gal. To take on that you're going to want to improvise and make that your focus as a string player. I mean, you might dabble in it and your classical gig, you know, you're mainly making a living as a classical musician and you improvise a bit. But if you're saying to the world, hey, I am an improvising string player, right away, you're a rebellious soul.
Right.
Now, string quartets, you know, traditionally in a traditional string quartet, you can't quit. You have to die to quit a string quartet. The membership is locked in for life, dude. And so that's the kind of the theory of a string quartet. People say all the bad things of a marriage and none of the good. There's all sorts of jokes about string quartets out there as well. The thing about the nature of Turtle Island is it's so based on these creative voices is that we've had tremendous turnover. And we used to call the viola chair the exploding viola chair because there were so many people coming through because the viola would be the hardest to play. And so the poor violinist that made the exciting decision 3 years later, we discover, wow, my back's hurting. This is really hard.
If you need reference on an exploding chair, please rent the film Spinal Tap and look at the bass player. That's what you need to do.
Exactly.
The bass player is a drummer. It's a drummer that exploded. Sorry, not the bass player. It's a drummer who kept exploding.
It's the drummer,
yeah.
It's just perfect for us.
Going back to a live recording the Turtle Island Quartet made with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, back then led by Naimi Järvi, Here's a selection arranged by one of Turtle Island Quartet's many violists over the decades, in this case, Danny Seidenberg. Appropriate in this week where we have heartily celebrated the birthday of Johann Sebastian Bach, this is called Bach's Lunch. As you formed this quartet and you knew that this is what you wanted to do, you finally got you, Daryl, and John, and then the violas. I want you to talk about three areas which you had to then to face the reality of. But before that, take us back 30 years, because it was so different. You don't have to do that now, but it was so different. Your whole stage presence and what you did on stage was really quite different than what somebody going to Doylestown would see, because you were different, so you had to be different. Is that right? Correct? Kind of?
Well, I would say that I don't think that we were so clearly aware of why we were doing what we were doing in terms of our staging. It was something that it tends to follow the evolution of the quartet. So in the beginning, right out of the gate, we were really clear that we were doing something that had never been done before, a string quartet where all four members could solo, could improvise, and really were identified themselves as improvising players and trained in that and came together to try to fill the quartet thing. So we wanted a way to play that would send a signal to that. So part of it was experimenting with different staging. And sometime over the first 10 years of the band, I mean, it would get really out of hand. I mean, at one point, I think we had like wireless microphone. I'm looking back on that with running all over the stage and kicking over our music stands and having a kind of a grand old time. It got a little out of hand. I think what happened was, I remember, you know, especially with the wireless thing, that it wouldn't necessarily produce the best results in concert sometimes. So around 1997 or so, I think, is when there was this kind of realization that what really made this group special in the end was not the departure from the tradition, but the expansion of the tradition. And it made more sense to come back to the model of a more classical presentation. And we got much more towards a more acoustic presence, backed off on the electronic side and more came back towards the acoustic side, much more at that point, and remains so up to this point, even though we've gone back and forth with standing or sitting. These days, we're staying with the sitting model and also very much, of course, with the acoustic sound and quality and timbre. There's just so much you can do with these instruments that comes out in the acoustic framework better than the electronic one, in my experience.
At least in my mind, there were three things sort of facing you back in the mid-80s, whether you had the vision to look forward. And I sort of want to take them and then look over the history of Turtle Island, how you've met these challenges. One is repertoire. And what it seems like you've done is there's your compositions and others who have been in the group, but there's a lot of your works. There is not looking to other established composers to write for the quartet, and you can explain why. And then, of course, there's this covering of jazz standards, if you want to say, well-known jazz pieces, but also pieces from the pop world, the rock world, things like that. So that seems like that was your solution, kind of. Did it evolve? Or just talk about the repertoire this group has put forward, decisions you had to make.
That's a really good question, David. And it does come right to the core of how the group evolved. And for me, it was very much of an evolutionary thing, because what happened with me was that I was very much in love with this style of music I was involved in with this mandolin player named David Grisman, who was a mandolin player who still is playing great music. And he was one of the main progenitors of what you hear now with Bela Fleck and Chris Thiele and Edgar Meyer and all these great, great players in this American style that we hear. David was one of the, maybe I could go on and say he is the most important beginning point with what he came up with the David Grisman Quintet. And the violinist in the group was Daryl Anger, who I became best friends with. I was very much linked to him in my early days. And we were both very interested in the same things. And so what happened for me was that we were doing these kind of groups where we were playing jazz without a drummer. And, you know, there'd be mandolin and guitar and a couple violins, and Daryl was playing even some cello at one point, and then we would change around. It was kind of, we even played four violin things. That's where it kind of got my mind going, was we would do these four violin arrangements of fiddle tunes, and the crowd would go absolutely nuts. And so it was something about the four part that really caught me. And so then that's when I really was trying to find myself. And I said, my solution to this is to write real string quartet music based on this approach, but to really go towards the original music side of integrating style with the idea that players could deliver on that. So that's what I went for. So right out of the gate, though, it was an obvious thing putting the group together that it would be fun to play some jazz tunes, because that's what we'd been doing anyway.
Right.
So it was easy. I just put up some arrangements of some jazz charts for us to play, but I was all focused on my original music. And so we started playing concerts, and people went nuts for the jazz arrangements. And that's kind of like was my first sense that, you know, the way that I saw this group was not the way the rest of the world might see it. That the audience is having an easier time understanding us when they heard us playing a jazz tune they knew than dealing with my already pretty involved original music. So being the smart fellow that I was, I realized, you know, just go with this, see where it goes. And the other thing that was interesting to me was that when I would write the original music I played, that I wrote, that the players had to deliver on that more specifically to what I was looking for as a composer. Whereas in the jazz arrangements, they got to be more individual. They got to be playing more their own thing. And they liked that. And that opened the group up more as a real true group and not just a project to play my original music. And so that's kind of quickly became the way to go. And then their voices started developing. We then naturally were not dependent on needing other composers to write for us. And it became a hallmark of our group that we were self-producing of our own repertoire, which is to this day remains maybe the core most important part. Writing is a big part because, you know, you join a group like this and you better bring your A game if you're going to try to write, because it's like a string quartet. And that means we're not dabbling. I set the bar very high. And even for the arrangements, I want there always to be a high level of delivering on the compositional aspect so that, just as you're saying, we legitimately can produce music of the highest level without being written for by outside composers. The other thing with outside composers, especially back then, is if you took a jazz guy, even a famous one, he would tend to look at us as a string quartet.
Right.
And then a string quartet, they would want to write more of their classical masterpiece instead of like writing for us as a band. And so we would be wanting to play their hits, you know, and they would want to write their heavy piece, you know, that was all written out in more classical style. So this was a natural thing that it worked out the way it did.
Without naming names, did composers over the decades here, as people got to know you and heard the recordings, were you approached by composers to say, I'd like to write for you? And
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Still to this day. You know, that's always a difficult one for me because, you know, this is such, it's okay, so like you started this interview with me making a very good point is how will people understand what we're doing? So that's the question we have to deliver on in every concert we play. So still to this day, it makes the best way to do that is to play music that folks might actually recognize. and relate to, and so that they can get their hands on this, their head around this idea that there's this four players that are playing in a string quartet. They're playing in a different way than they're used to, and so that doesn't leave a lot of time to get into a lot of original music. So given that, and given for me especially, a big part of it is to be able to sing my song, and that's why I'm still here 30 years myself. So there's not all that much room for original music in that regard. The thing is all sorts of composers will approach us to submit music because that's what string quartets normally do. They play other people's music.
Right.
And that's the normal model. But I'm actually constantly in the space to say, you know, that's not how we're approaching this. Think of it as like a band. Why would a band play somebody else's music?
Right.
They'll play their own music, right? Now, there's, of course, all sorts of exceptions with great musicians who, especially jazz musicians, who we play with. So like, but with Paquito de Rivera, for instance, that worked out really well for him to write a piece for us. And we did all years of touring with him and working with him closely. And so that was a partnership in
right.
which we could perform together. There's, of course, exceptions to this, but primarily that's how we ended up the way we are. And I think it's a good thing. I mean, I've seen in the last few years, many more chamber music groups having a similar approach as somebody in the group's writing music for the group itself. More and more I see that.
Yeah, that's the trend.
These lines are blurred. It's this whole thing of the composer and the performer. The composer writes his piece, the performer plays the composer's piece, and there's this separation in the Western classical style. And in jazz, of course, it's not that way at all. So you're seeing classical chamber music forms starting to evolve towards that more jazz American integrated, kind of almost like a recapturing, because if you go back to the original string quartet form, those guys could all improvise.
Right.
That was part of their skill set, as they were improvisers back then. So.
From one of my guests, the Turtle Island Quartet's most recent recordings, a Grammy-nominated disc called Confetti Man on the Azika label, here is their take on the fun jazz standard by pianist Bud Powell called Bouncin' with Bud.
Thank you.
the jazz tunes or other tunes, if it's a Bob Dylan tune or something, the pieces you arrange, is it just as simple as I or we love this tune? Or is there some overarching thing of trying to string things together from past years with different arrangements? I mean, is there a rhyme or reason to which tunes get the Turtle arrangement?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's a complicated one to answer because it's a little of both. The way that this works, and this is an important part for a group like ours that's trying to cover such a wide swath of style. I mean, we're, of course, primarily known as a string quartet that can play jazz, but we're also, on a deeper level, looking how to deeply combine the various elements of classical music and jazz music. You can spend your whole life in one of those styles. You can spend your whole life in two of those, just the two, but it's been our nature also, and mine as well, to want to cover other styles like folk music and you mentioned pop music and rock, and then I'm interested in music from India. We've gotten interested in music from Latin America, South America, and various different. So when you're really wanting to take that wide of an approach, which this group can do because of the grounding elements that are present, then it's important that the players have a willingness to have some respect and love what they're drawing from to create that mix. At the same time, you can't just do anything you want and just make it work. It's too confusing. So a lot of times what happens is we'll have specific projects in mind. The one that comes to mind is the one we're playing this season, which is we're playing our perennial program, the music of John Coltrane. It's called Love Supreme, the Legacy of John Coltrane. I think that's a good example of when we came together to focus on more specifically what we wanted to do and chose our writing to fit that rather than simply relying on our own inspiration. So in that regard, we're trying to put together a full concert of music that fits together, that fits a theme. And that particular one worked really, really well for us.
I'm curious from a musician standpoint, and we have enough listeners who would know I'm talking about. When you guys do the improvisations in an arrangement, is it as a jazz player would have, meaning does your music not have notation? It's just the chord changes? Is that what you're given in your scores, just like a jazz player would?
It's not. It's a very wide range of fully through composed music to just like what we call in jazz a lead sheet.
Right.
Like, so we are a string quartet that can play for you where everybody's just reading over a standard jazz lead sheet, meaning all you would see was a melody with chords written on top of the melody. And we would play for you a full 5 or 10 minute thing if we wanted to, because that's the tradition of jazz.
Right.
So we are able to do that because we're able to emulate the roles of the rhythm section. And that's the, in a jazz band, it's mostly commonly said as piano, bass, and drums. The piano is also sometimes sub for guitar. And so the roles of those three instruments are pretty obvious. You have the bass playing the walking line below, and you have the percussion, of course, and then the piano player is, or guitar player is supplying the harmonic background, and then people are soloing over that. So we came up with a way where we could come up with a four-part solution by that. So the most basic solution is the cellist. He can play, when he sees the changes in the chord progression, he can play the bass line. Up till about a year and a half ago, for our whole existence, Mark Summer has been the cellist, and
right. He's
an incredibly amazing player. And so it was recently that I went through this major life change is to have a new cellist. And I'm happy we figured that out. And it's interesting, like all these years later, whereas when we were first coming up, Mark was completely unprecedented. But now there's a fair amount of really talented young cellists who can play jazz and who can play the cello in ways that's like a bass. And the tradition has really opened up. And Malcolm Parson, our current cellist, is just a monster.
Yeah.
He's 27 years old. He keeps me up at night. Both the young guys are like baby turtles. They're wonderful players, and I call them baby turtles because they're so cute, but they certainly bite, as they should. So they just keep me going, and I feel very energized by that. And so back to the cello role. So the role of the instrument in our group is that it plays the part of the bass in that context. The second part I would point to would be something we call the chop, which is for string players out there. It's a fairly documented technique now. You can find videos that teach it. It's a technique that's even listed on the Wikipedia technique for violin technique. Chops and shuffle bow is the other one. And those are both from American folk fiddle tradition. Those techniques allow us to kind of play kind of more the percussion part as well as some of the harmonic language. And then the third element is the idea of the piano for that. If you know how to, you can pick out the right notes in a chord progression called the leading tones. And so each of those three roles, any of the of us can do. And even our violist will sometimes walk bass lines for the cellist to solo over. So, and that leaves one person to solo. So you can imagine you got the bass part, the drum part, the piano part, and the soloist. That's four. And so we play, we're jamming on a chord progression and like say All the Things You Are or whatever jazz tune. And then you look around and see what's changing and you just adapt to that. And it's a very idiomatically satisfying model. And then when you combine that with really composing, you get more of the full picture. So if you actually look at a Turtle Island chart, you'll see the traditional Turtle Island jazz chart will have a very strong similarity to what you would see with big band charts.
Right.
Where there's a lot of writing, but there's sections for allowing for solos as well. Yeah. There you have it.
Yeah, visually you're looking at a string quartet, which is the wonder of this whole thing. The second area you had to traverse over these decades, we've already talked a little bit about, there's been a lot of personnel changes. I mean, you even left the quartet and came back for a while. And I'm wondering if we could come up to the present day. You mentioned Malcolm, but I wonder if you might mention the other two in the group and what strengths they bring so that they can be a member of Turtle Island. I mean, there's been a lot of personnel changes, but the personnel changes have to be rather specific as to who's going to fill that chair. Malcolm, is it, like you said, he's a monster on cello, but mention the other two young turtles in your group.
Yeah, and I should finish up with Malcolm first before I move on.
Sure, yeah.
What's interesting about Malcolm is this group before he joined Turtle Island was a group called the Carolina Chocolate Drops, which is a fantastic group that's playing in this kind of more of American roots style that he was excellent at and is excellent at. When Mark Summer quit the group a couple of years ago now, it was so daunting. And just somehow, this was very daunting to even figure out how it was even possible to do. Mm-hmm. And as luck would have it, Malcolm was just in the process of what was happening with Drops was is that Rhiannon was moving fast towards more of a solo career and there was going to be more space for Malcolm anyway. And then the other thing with Turtle Island is that Malcolm has such a great skill set that it gave him a more of a better base to show his stuff. So he made the transition and I was taken care of in some magical, amazing way. And very grateful to that. And I try not to let him know that too much. Because I'm teasing. Anyway, moving on to our other young player. They're all young compared to me, but relatively speaking, quite young, which would be Alex Hargraves. He's on violin like me, and so I'm going to point to him as a fascinating example of a very recent development in American music, and that is that you're starting to see these young players coming out of the American fiddle scene who can play all over the instrument with such incredible technical skill, who will draw on classical technique as one of several styles, as opposed to the usual of my generation, where somebody improvising the violin, by and large, was completely, fully classically trained. And so this is a new thing. I started to see this happening about 8 years ago. I'd hear these players and these kids and go, wow, what is up with that? Because there's these guys like Mark O'Connor and Daryl Anger and Matt Glazer and all these people who are out doing these incredible teaching things and inspiring young players from the fiddle tradition to cover a lot of ground. And so, you know, Alex is of that same ilk. He just 2 weeks ago was featured on Prairie Home Companion with Chris Thiele and with Julian Lodge and all these incredible players, all this list of amazing young monster players. And so he brings that fresh American quality. And I'm really proud to say that Turtle Island had a big role in making that happen. So it's like watching your circle turn, I don't know, watch your life keep rolling and just keep rolling with it. And then finally, I come to Benny, who's our violist. And you mentioned earlier that we've had a history of violinists switching to viola. And so Benny is one of three real violists we've had in the quartet. And I think he's the third one that the charm. I mean, the other two are amazing as well. But Benny's right up there and moving us forward. He's an interesting story because he started playing the violin since he was 4 years old. He's from Europe. He's from Germany. And his family is very famous in the classical world. His father is a well-known, renowned director of music conservatories. He was the director of the Bruckner Conservatory and then later the Mozarteum in Salzburg, where Mozart was born. Very famous. This is like Juilliard. He grew up in a family where all the kids all had to play string instruments, and they had a string quartet. in their family, and Benny was the bad boy. He was playing viola, but darn, he was going to play jazz. And so he completely, you know, I'm sure horrified his parents. They're very sweet, and they're very happy that Benny is doing this because their son has found a place. So he's got that incredible European tradition, yet he's completely, thoroughly a jazz musician. He actually has a master's in jazz studies from Manhattan School of Music, where he was studying with some of the greats of jazz, David Lieben and Jim McNeely. Great, great teachers. So those are the three that we got now, and there's me, Senior Turtle. Actually, we're based out of Brooklyn these days. That's another whole long story. Okay. That these players don't grow on trees. I kind of realized, even though I live in the Bay Area, that to make this work, I was going to have to let go of it, that it was going to be move everybody to the Bay Area, make them, you know, live here. They all want to live in New York. That's the life. They live in Brooklyn. So I actually fly to Brooklyn, and I sleep on the floor of Benny's office room in his apartment, and we rehearse and we tour. And so I got to hit the ground running. I'm leaving on Thursday, and I'll be doing my imitation young man thing. And I have a feeling that as crazy as my life is, it's going to be something I'll look back on as a good move for keeping my spirit young and vibrant, even though it's kind of crazy. That's the hope.
You'll hang out in those crowds of hipsters where you're definitely the oldest one of the crowd.
Oh, there's no question. I try to go with them at night. They go to the clubs, of course, and I'm like hanging out. It's kind of odd. It's definitely odd to be the old guy. It's kind of funny. I'm in my sixth decade, to be totally honest, and early at least, but still, it's quite an experience. I'm playing with people, the two of them are younger than my own children, you know, so it's like, and yet, you know, we're equals. I have to really remember that. And it's not hard to remember when we're playing. It's really clear that we're all equals on the playing field. And so that's the beauty of it. And that means it's going to keep going as far as I can tell.
Yeah. That last area, which was, you know, when you started in the mid 80s in the Bay Area, was, you know, who would book us and who would, but, you know, things happened over the years. And, you know, not only did you play, but, you know, recordings came out like with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and all this stuff on major labels and boom. Once again, from the Turtle Island Quartet's recent recording on the Azika label, the critically acclaimed and Grammy-nominated CD titled Confetti Man, this is an original composition by my guest, violinist David Balakrishnan, called Alex in A Major. Thank you. as I said, I've interviewed a lot of string quartets on this program over the years, and a lot of them are these young quartets. And many of them, even if they are still playing the Beethoven cycles and the Brahms and the Schumanns, and that's the new hot composer to play now, and or the Shostakovichs and the Bartoks, when I ask for mentors, you know, it's Kronos and it's you guys. Or you, I should say, because, you know, they're listening to past incarnations of Turtle Island. That should make you proud in one sense that what you started 30 years ago, figuring out repertoire, figuring out how to get improvisers in there, find out where to play, you know, it has transferred. It has resonated not only with audiences, but with these young players. So,
David, that's such an important thing. And sometimes, of course, it can feel really daunting to keep going. But just hearing that reminds me to keep the faith and stick to your guns, so to speak. Stick to what brought you to the table and have faith in that. And I am really grateful for that. And when I first came up, I had the sense that Turtle Island was going to be an important voice. And the way things turned out 30 years later, I see it's a lot different than I really expected when I was younger. When I was really young, I really thought the whole thing was going to change really rapid. That's youth. You know, you look at, this has got to change. Come on.
Right.
And so it didn't. It changed in the way that it changed. And the role we played was what it was as opposed to what I envisioned. And of course, reality had a better idea than I did. And that's kind of what I see, the beauty of the way that it actually ended up. I proselytize for young players to develop their improvising voice. And I will go to my grave doing that. That's the thing I think still, it will always need to be championed on this bowed stringed instrument. And it's still difficult to get in place in a institutional way in school systems where young people learn and with teachers. That's a work in progress. And at the same time, I don't want to lose the essence of where the tradition came from. And I don't think that'll happen. I'm interested in some ways that the younger players will not necessarily be as fascinated with the harmonic language of bebop jazz the way I was. The reason I mention that is because the Western style of polyphony is incredibly intensely complicated and deep. The vocabulary is very like Latin. It's like a major language thing. So the bebop jazz guys were the ones who were able to reclaim the ability to improvise in that complicated way, of that complex polyphonic way. I'm using all these big words. It's hard to express. It's not something you just do. You have to spend years. You have to serve it, just like you have to serve how to play classical music. So young players, sometimes they're more bypassing that element these days. And so my desire is to push to not lose the grounding and the vocabulary so that string players can stand up with the great jazz musicians, the young ones that are coming out now as well. And by and large, you're seeing that that's happening the right way, again, at its pace and not necessarily the pace that I thought it would happen at.
I hope the three young guys around you can keep you young. You can keep going for a number more years.
Well, I mean, well, for me, as you get older, you start seeing your body changes. You become wiser, but your energy and your methodology has to adapt. And then you also see how much you have to offer to younger players. Even if they can sprint and you're not sprinting at the same speed, it's amazing how in sharing the space with younger players like that, there's this natural exchange that happens. I guess it's an obvious thing to say, but it's a real revelation for me to experience. And I'll just leave it there.
That's great. Well, I close on my cadenza interviews by asking my guests two quick questions. If you could chat like we've been chatting with someone from the past, pick their brain, what's the first name that pops into your head? And there's a lot probably, but when I asked that question, what was the first name that popped in? If you could chat with somebody from the past you never had a chance to talk to.
Well, the first name that popped my mind was John Coltrane.
It would be.
Just because I didn't get to hear him. I heard Hendrix.
Right.
You know, of course it would have been great to talk, but Coltrane was the voice that when I would hear him play, I would hear that he was connected in a way that was beyond my understanding. The second one was Bach, actually. It was weird. It was Coltrane to Bach, like in this kind of split second. You know, again, how can that happen musically?
Oh, yeah.
What is he like? I've heard interviews with Coltrane and heard his voice, but, you know, I'd want to sit and talk to him. I realized that I'd be terrified, but I still want to try.
Well, I think Bach and Coltrane would have gotten along famously, actually, Bach alone on the organ bench with Coltrane next to him, that would have been fascinating.
Oh, can you imagine those two souls?
I can't even.
Oh, my God.
The final question is a non-musical question, meaning everybody interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy. But when you have to do something non-musical, take yourself away from it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do that can pull yourself away when you need to get away? So you're sleeping on the floor in Brooklyn.
You know, I guess the thing I've lately gotten into, I mean, I used to play golf. That was my thing to do. And then I had a shoulder injury happen where I luckily could still play the violin just fine, but the golf swing was going to take a back seat. So since I kind of like when you asked that question, I got to somehow reclaim that because that was a real healthy alternative. Golf's one of those games that has very similar feeling to playing an instrument. You know, you can be an old guy, you can play and actually engage in the sport. A lot of the specifics of it, there's a rhythm to it. So even though I'm not playing now, that's the answer I would give, okay. I would say. Mm-hmm. Is that's the thing that when I look at what I am drawn to do when I can. It's just been a few months now that I've been able to go there. So instead of that, I'm watching, gotten very much into the Jewel and the Crown and then Downton Abbey, watching TV series with my wife at home. Oh, I have to say one more thing. I've discovered cooking.
Oh, good.
So I've been cooking dinner for my wife who just passed the bar so recently. And so she's working as a lawyer, which I'm very grateful to, by the way. Yeah. And so I am taking on my role as musician, house husband, and cooking dinner and getting much more into that. So it's funny, the question makes me laugh because I have such a hard time knowing what I do. It seems like I wake up, I obsess, and I go to sleep. So anyway.
David Ball, Christian, thanks for taking some time.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Violinist, composer, and founder of the Turtle Island Quartet, David Balakrishnan. You can find out all you wish to know about the Turtle Island Quartet at their website, turtleislandquartet.com. Their Doylestown, PA concert last fall was a really fun event, where a lot of John Coltrane was performed. I leave you with more of that great jazz musician's music as arranged by Turtle Island Quartet. Actually, this is Coltrane's famous take on the Richard Rodgers classic show tune, My Favorite Things, performed by Turtle Island Quartet, led by their founder, composer, violinist, and my guest today, David Balakrishnan. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.